Justice of the Colorado Supreme Court, Justice Louis Rivera. We have just one case for oral argument this morning, case 08-CA-242. In re the estate of Scott, we've allotted 30 minutes per side for argument. We have received the outlines, your outlines. We appreciate your providing those to us. Counsel for both sides are here and prepared to go.
We are for the appellant, Your Honor.
We are for the appellant.
And any questions regarding the procedure here today? Right, let's proceed.
May it please the court. I am Larry Hamill, and with me at council table is Alicia Smith, who joined me on the briefs, an attorney in my office. This is a case where it is virtually impossible to know where to start. As you can see, we have filed expanded briefs, and you have allotted us additional time for oral argument today because of the number of issues that have developed over 10 years of litigation in this two-petition case. It has spiraled, we believe, totally out of control. It has gone far beyond the scope of the original petitions that were filed in this case and has resulted in the morass of issues that are now pending before this court. We designated over 30 issues on appeal in our notice of appeal. Obviously, we did not address all of those in our briefs. We're not able to address even the issues that we addressed in our brief in our oral argument today. I would be happy, of course, to answer any questions that anybody on the panel has with respect to any of the issues in the briefs, but we will try and adhere to the outline that we provided to the court. Because the case is such a morass at this point in time, I think it behooves looking back at how this case started. It started with the filing of two petitions by one of the beneficiaries of a dozen or so beneficiaries of the family trust. This petition was filed within days, literally days, after the death of W.C. Scott, who was one of the settlors of the trust. As the court knows, the other settlor of the trust was Sophia Scott, who had been adjudged incompetent, and who was acting through Samuel Scott as her conservator. The trust had been signed some years before her death, a couple of years before her death, had been amended once before her death, and we will address that one amendment. The petition in this case has set forth some very discrete issues. The petitioner in this case, as I said, was one of the beneficiaries, one of only a dozen or so beneficiaries. And he set forth in his petition several claims for equitable relief. Nothing particularly unique about the petition. It did not raise issues of competence, did not raise issues of unjust or of undue influence. It simply sought several kinds of equitable relief, including the removal of Samuel Scott as trustee and the imposition of a surcharge. These specific and discrete issues have been more or less lost in the process by which this case has proceeded. But those petitions were never amended. There was a third petition in the will case that was filed by Samuel Scott two or three years afterwards. That petition is subsumed by the other petitions that are filed. None of the other beneficiaries ever joined in this litigation. And important for this appeal, the trustee, the successor trustee who was appointed, we believe, improperly by the probate court, improperly and inconsistently with the terms of the trust agreement. That successor trustee never joined in the petition, never filed his own petition, never sought any relief in the court. He was, however, granted relief by the probate court, an oddity which we address in our briefs, because it is beyond my comprehension how someone, some entity, some person who is not a party to the lawsuit can either be held by the judgment in that case or be benefited by the judgment in that case.
Mr. Hamill, to clarify on this issue, is the trust itself not before the court? I mean, what wasn't there a petition regarding the trust, and didn't the probate court exercise its authority with regard to the trust?
Those are really two questions, Your Honor.
Sure.
And no, the trust was not before the court. The trust was obviously the issue. simply like any other issue would be before the court on a complaint and answer, but the trust was not before the court. Much was said in the briefs of the appellees about the jurisdiction of the court. We do not contest the jurisdiction of the probate court to exercise control within the statute and within the pleadings that present the issues before it. But the probate court, no more than any other court, is permitted to expand the scope of the proceeding before it willy-nilly.
Well, Mr. Hamill, let me maybe get some facts straight in my own mind. In fact, as I read the record from the briefs in this case, in February of 2000, Mark, a little close speaker, grandson, initiated a petition in the trust case. He asserted various breaches of trust, that's saying that A, B, and G, and installed an accounting as to the appointment of the trustee. He requested the appointment of an independent trustee. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then, as a result of all that, the court concluded that Samuel had failed to file certain documents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, engaged himself daily, and appointed Mr. Holt as a trustee, as a special trustee. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then in January of 2002, Holt prepared the court order report. And then Samuel, your client, filed a pleading entitled Samuel's Objections to Compensation and Expenses of Excessive Trustee. Is that correct?
There is a separate, we have objected to reports and fees that are claimed in those reports. There's a separate proceeding with respect to Mr. Holt.
In the objection, Samuel asserted that Holt had overcharged the family trust so many dollars in fees and accounting services and so forth. Is that? And then Samuel filed an additional objection to the fees paid out to the family trust between July of 2002 and May of 2007. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. In total, Samuel objected. Nearly $400,000 in fees paid out to the family, out of the family trust to hold a bookkeeping business and three law firms. Is that correct? Am I on the right track?
Well, you're on this a dual track, Your Honor.
I understand I'm on a dual track, but
Those are correct facts, yes.
Okay. And then in March of 2005, Samuel filed a new petition against Holt in another case, 05 PR 446. Is that correct?
Yes.
And he again alleged, Samuel led to, had failed to respond to certain requests and so forth and so on. The probate court dismissed the petition, including that Holt had provided the county and so forth. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in April of 07, filed another petition against Holt in the trust case, and he asserted that Holt had acted beyond the scope of the court ordered appointment. True or false?
There is a separate petition.
Yeah. Specifically, he asserted that Holt had improperly conducted an extensive factual inquiry surrounding the creation of the medical trust. Is that correct?
I believe that is one of the allegations in the petition, yes.
And he reasserted many of the same objections. I'll call it the eight objections that he had already previously referred to. Is that correct?
Well, the objections that were filed in the trust proceeding were objections filed by him as a beneficiary. The objections filed.
And Samuel is a beneficiary?
He is a beneficiary.
Okay. But not as a trustee under the will.
He was removed as trustee.
Yes. And then Holt took a position before the court regarding the fees.
Well, Holt has never filed any petition with the court, filed no reports with the court, no details as to his fees.
At least the way I read the fact in this case, in May of 07, Holt filed his own petition against Samuel and Samuel's counsel. And Holt asserted that Samuel have impacted, acted improperly, hold asserted that standing in this council had acted improperly in filing needless and vexatious pleading relating to fees, accounting, and production of documents in relation to the digital. In support, hold cited in that petition, Samuel's 8 objections, the petitions in 05, PR 446, and April 2007. Is that correct or incorrect?
Well, I think what you're doing is conflating various pleadings that were filed in different capacities.
I'm trying to pull them all together to see what we got.
Well, we have two proceedings. We have the Will case and the Trust case.
This is, okay.
Those are the ones we're here for today.
In June of 07, the probate court entered its initial order resolving the issue resolved that were raised in Mark's petition to probate the original will in first counsel and invalidated the second counsel. Is that correct?
It did.
According to the Will case.
It invalidated the second codicil in the will, case.
Thank you. Now, back to the trust case, just for a moment. What is the, you say that basically the appellee is saying that there's no final order, therefore we should dismiss the trust case because we don't have jurisdiction here today. Is that correct?
They take that position, yes.
And what about your position?
Our position is that there's a final order in this case.
Correct me exactly where the final order is.
The court has entered what it called itself the final order.
Okay, tell me where.
It's in June of, I do not know the pleading, Your Honor, but I can point it out to you.
Why would you do that?
There is a final order, and it was entered by the court on December 28, 2007. And it's denominated.
December
of 2007.
2007.
And it is denominated final order and judgment.
Final order.
And that's on the.
Where can we find that?
I don't have the record citation, Your Honor, but I'm sure it was attached to our original notice of appeal.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Hamill, the difficulty I have is that the petitioner comes in the trust case and asks the court to remove Samuel as the trustee. The court obviously at that point is exercising its power with regard to the trust and the administration of the trust. Later, the court orders Samuel to make certain payments to the trust, and that the original inter vivos trust, of course, doesn't exist anymore. All that exists now are the sub-trusts. How is it that the trust is not before the court and the duties of the trustee are not before the court? I'm having difficulty.
I think that the trust as a concept is before the court because that's the focus of the litigation. But the trust is not a party. The trust has never appeared. Mr. Mark Scott, who is the petitioner in this case, never purported to act on behalf of the trust. My problem with this is this res judicata as to the trust. How can it be res judicata as to the trust if it's not a party? How can collateral estoppel exist?
Excuse me, I can understand if the trust were complaining that it was being ordered to do something and that it had never been brought into the litigation, but you're arguing that you cannot be required, your client cannot be required to make certain payments, that certain surcharges into the trust because the trust is not before the court.
Surcharge is a relief, an equitable relief that was sought by Mark Scott. And yes, the probate court can certainly order that equitable relief. But what it did here was enter judgments for damages, punitive damages, and a whole range of different relief directly to the trust. And the trust never sought that relief. And neither did Mark Scott ever seek that relief on behalf of the trust. He had no standing. And so it is as if someone who was a complete stranger to the pleadings in the case, even though his interests might be involved. I mean, take a real property case, for example. If there's three or four people who have an interest in a piece of real property, and one of them brings a lawsuit, is that lawsuit and the result of that lawsuit binding on the other three? No, it clearly is not, even though the lease of the litigation was the real property.
Whose right is it to raise this issue? I mean, your concern is you cannot be required, your client cannot be required to pay certain damages into a non-party, if you will. Where is it that this is a legal right of yours not to be so ordered to pay damages to a trust? That your client was formerly the trustee of.
To be ordered a surcharge is one thing. What has happened here is the award of damages, which in an equitable proceeding is inappropriate. The award of punitive damages in an equitable proceeding, which is improper. The award of attorney's fees to a non-party, which is improper. We've raised a whole range of issues with respect to the various surcharges, most fundamentally of which are the equitable defenses, which are available for all those surcharges. Would those equitable defenses have been available to the trustee? I don't know. Would the statute of limitations been available to the trustee? I don't know. They certainly were with respect to the claim of Mr. Mark Scott. And it is Mark Scott who's prosecuting this litigation. It is Mark Scott who sought the surcharge. If the court had simply entered a surcharge, that's one thing. It did not just do that. And the court also disregarded the various defenses, which are all clear and well-established defenses under the law of trusts and under the general law of statutes of limitation and equitable defenses anyhow. And so what we've done is convolute this, what was started out as a rather simple process, a simple lawsuit that was started by Mark Scott on his own behalf with his own claims, some of which are equitable in nature and some of which involve surcharge, if permissible, that's fine. But until the trust enters an appearance, how are we to know what our rights are? We have not had an adjudication of the trust's rights, even though there's been an award of damages to the trust.
The crux of your argument, and I understand it, is that the court exceeded, the trial court exceeded its authority. Whether the award of attorney be a punitive damage in an equitable action against Zach.
That's certainly one of our thrusts, the thrust of one of our arguments.
But Mark's original petition did ask for fees and costs and exemplary damages.
For his. He asked for exemplary damages, not at all. He asked for exemplary damages on his theft claim, which he didn't have standing to assert in the first place, but he had a theft claim in his petition. He did not ask for damages, and in fact, in one of the pretrial orders in this case, trial management order, he said they were not seeking damages. Mr. Mark Scott was not seeking damages, he was simply seeking equitable relief in the nature of surcharge. And that is what his petition said.
Didn't his petition ask for reimbursement for losses, fees, costs?
His fees, costs, his losses, losses by way of surcharge to the trust estate. That's what he sought. He did not seek damages.
Now, this issue about the damages that you're concerned about, you argued this to the trial court?
Which issue about the damages?
Now, as I'm understanding it, you're saying, okay, surcharges are one thing, but damages to be paid to the trust is a problem for you because the trust is not properly before the court.
When that order came down, Your Honor, there had been no indication that there were going to be any damages awarded to the trust by the court.
So this was the first time the issue was created was when the court entered that order.
There were two orders entered. There was one, a findings of facts and conclusions, and then a judgment, basically, is what the final judgment in order. So yes, until those came down, we had no indication that the trust was a party. In fact, the court had excluded the trustee as a witness non-party to the proceedings. And we had raised it at that point. Nobody objected. She was clear in her ruling to exclude Mr. Holt and invite him back as a witness. And so, no, we did not anticipate that there would be this kind of award of damages. And to answer your question, we did not raise any post-trial motions candidly, that would have been an exercise in futility, as has most of what we've done in the last 10 years.
Mr. Hamel, pardon me for interrupting you. I'd like to talk about another issue that you've raised. I want to be sure that you have an opportunity to address this, if I may.
Sure.
Talking about the mental competence of the deceased as far as the appointment of the trustee, do I understand your position correctly that you feel that the opinion issued by this court found at 119 Pacific 3rd somehow foreclosed the trial court from making any decisions about that mental competence on remand?
I do, Your Honor.
Would you please explain that to me? And in doing so, would you please explain to me why the very last section of the opinion in 119 P. 3rd does not indicate that the trial court was supposed to make additional determinations about the decedent's mental competence 2 years before the codicil?
Logically and legally, if the codicil is a valid document, which this court held in the decision you've referred to, written by Judge Carparelli, in that decision, the first finding was, we conclude that the probate court erred when it denied proponents Samuel Scott's motion for summary judgment regarding decedent's testamentary capacity. That's what that motion for summary judgment was all about, was decedent's testamentary capacity. This court found that the second codicil was valid. It is logically impossible to find that the second codicil was valid and at the same time leave open the issue of the competence of Mr. W.C. Scott.
Well, how do you explain, help me follow up on that question, how do you explain the fact that we determined in Mark's motion, Mark of summary judgment, that there were contested issues of fact, and yet there are no contested issues, and we able to decide whether you argue sure. We can decide.
The contest
that provision decided that.
What you said, what the court said, was that the evidence presented by Mark, which was essentially this Dr. Ogawa's letter, was so remote in time that it was irrelevant and incompetent as evidence. It said, therefore, there was the issue of the competence was not established for Mark's ruling, for Mark's motion for summary judgment, but he presented no evidence to contest our motion for summary judgment. And the court, in an unusual manner, found that our motion should have been granted. And the reason it found that was because it was determinative of the issues that were pending before the court. So that there were sufficient contested issues of fact to deny Mark's motion for summary judgment. There were none to deny our motion for summary judgment. The final order of this court back to Judge Stewart was to take further proceedings in accordance with this order. Those further proceedings would have been to enter that summary judgment in favor of Samuel Scott.
That's well, with regard to the Samuel Scott's testamentary capacity to execute a codicil.
W.C. Scott's.
W.C.'s to execute a codicil. But didn't the opinion also say, but there needs to be evidence taken with regard to whether he still had the power of appointment under the terms of the trust?
How can the two be separated? If he had the capacity to exercise, to execute the codicil is how you exercise the power of appointment.
Well, let me ask you this. If he had said, and I bequeathed to my son, Mark, my palace in Versailles. Now, he could have testamentary capacity to write that codicil, but the bequest would fail if he didn't truly own the palace in Versailles, wouldn't
he? Sure, but that has nothing to do with his capacity. It has to do with the fact that he didn't own the property.
Well, so let's go to that. So did he have the power of appointment? This is not the question of whether he had the capacity to execute a codicil. The question is, did he possess a power of appointment at the time? And that was the question that we referred back to the court. Did he have that power of appointment?
The power of appointment was exercisable only by will. That's what it said. In the trust agreement, the original trust agreement, it says he has a power of appointment exercisable by will. We had this issue before this Court of Appeals as well, as to that part of the...
But it only existed so until such time as a doctor declared that he lacked the capacity to exercise that point. Wasn't there in the trust agreement a particular provision that says this power of appointment will be lost, in effect, if a doctor writes a letter?
No, that provision in the will to which you are referring said that the trustees may consider the person at issue, WC in this case, as incompetent in light of a letter setting forth his incompetence. That's what it said. May, permissive. That letter was written 2 years before the second codicil was executed. There was no evidence presented by Mark with respect to the competence at the time, the specific time the second codicil was executed.
Well, let me. Here's the difficulty I have, and you're not quite on target with explaining it to me. My understanding is that the power of appointment was given, but that there was a question of whether it could be exercised after a doctor wrote such a letter.
That was the thrust of the argument originally on Mark's motion for summary judgment, was that contract provision. This court ruled that was not what should be governed. It should be the Cunningham test.
That was as to testamentary capacity. Very clearly, there's no doubt that what the opinion says is as to the power to write a will. WC had the power to write a will.
Okay, had the power to exercise, because the only way to exercise that power of appointment was by writing a will.
If it continued to exist, and that's my question, did the power to appoint still exist at the time?
I can't imagine why not.
Wasn't there a condition with regard to this letter, a doctor's letter?
I just told you what the provision was, and that was that he could be deemed to have lack of... This was an administrative provision. If you look at where this shows up in the trust, it says, you know, you could pay money out to somebody on behalf of a minor beneficiary, and if you get a letter like this, you may treat the person as being incapacitated. First of all, Dr. Ogawa's letter didn't say he was incapacitated. It covered none of the issues having to do with Cunningham, which this court ruled to be the appropriate issues.
Well, that's just a testamentary capacity. But if I grant you a power of attorney and I say you have that power, so long as you continue to own that red Corvette, but if you get rid of that red Corvette, you no longer have the power.
But there's nothing in the trust that divests him of his power of appointment. It says you have a power of appointment. There is a provision that says we can treat you as incompetent. It has nothing to do with the power, does not mention the power of appointment. It says if you're going to exercise the power of appointment, you do it by will. This court has ruled that he had testamentary capacity to exercise that power of appointment. I don't see how it logically could follow that he did not have the power of appointment.
Under the provisions, what, 10.1, 10.4?
Something like that, yes.
That's really no force in effect as far as you're concerned.
Well, first of all, the letter didn't even comply with that section, but secondly, it mentioned not the power of appointment or anything else.
So then that became a question of fact, which we referred back to the trial.
Well, I don't read your opinion that way, Your Honor, because you say that he had testamentary capacity and the codicil, second codicil, was valid. I think it logically follows. It's a syllogism. It's beyond my comprehension as a matter of logic to say that he did not have testamentary capacity if the second codicil was a valid second codicil and it was exercised at a time.
Where we're departing is this. The question is, can he give away something that he does not possess? One thing about his testamentary capacity, his capacity to write a will, it's another thing to give away what he does not have. And if he does not have a power of appointment, how does he do that? And so there is a distinction about whether the power of appointment was alive when he exercised it. And I don't hear any argument that addresses that.
The probate court didn't rule that. The probate court ruled that he had no testamentary capacity to execute the codicil. Well, and that was directly covered by your ruling.
Well, wait a minute. In respect to the 119 Pacific opinion, Judge Stewart, trial judge, says on page 4 of her order, this court accepts that the Court of Appeals having found a genuine issue of material fact as to capacity to exercise the power of appointment, requires this court now to schedule notice and hold an evidence hearing on the capacity of William Scott to exercise the power of appointment by will.
That's testament of capacity. It has nothing to do with the existence or non-existence of the power of appointment.
Women. And contrary-wise, the Court of Appeals held that this court erred in failing to grant partial summary judgment to the respondent on the basis that this court should have made a summary factual finding without notice or hearing that the decedent had testamentary capacity to execute the second consul because all the elements of the Cunningham test had been met by the evidence submitted by the opponent. The court cannot do both. Hear the evidence on capacity to exercise the power of appointment by will, which is the second consul, while simultaneously admitting the second consul to probate and validating the exercise of the power of appointment without hearing any evidence. Now that was her, that was the trial judge's remarks relating to this issue. Help me understand why you think the opposite position that decision in the 119 to 73 resolved that question.
Because it determined that the codicil was valid and that W.C. Scott had testamentary capacity at the time that it was executed. It did not mention, this court did not mention in its decision anything about the existence of a power of appointment. The trial court did not mention or rule upon the existence of a power of appointment as having somehow or another been removed from W.C. Scott 2 years before he exercised it. And it makes no sense to me, logically or legally, that someone could validly exercise, but could validly execute a will which purports to exercise a power of appointment, and that somehow or another gotten lost in the shuffle. This court ruled that he had capacity and that the second codicil was valid. How can she hold a hearing later saying he did not have the capacity? She did not rule that he had lost the power of appointment. She ruled that he was incapable, either through undue influence or incompetence, to execute the second codicil. Exactly what this court ruled he did have. The law of the case should be binding.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, your job is rather easier because you know and understand the questions that we have asked, but the issues we've been referring.
Good morning, Your Honors. Gary Sims for the appellee and cross appellant. And with me at counsel's table is Frank Suyat, who worked with me in preparing the briefs in this matter. Luckily, we're going to start with where, in my outline, where the court ended questioning the appellant. And that is whether the attempted exercise of the power appointment was void ab initio, as we maintain. What I think is lost in all of this is that power of appointment was a qualified power of appointment. It was qualified by provisions in the trust.
Paragraph 10.1?
10.09 is actually the paragraph. 10.09 actually set up a system that I think is fairly typical in trust drafting, and that is to try to provide for provisions when a trustee or someone who has interest in the trust becomes ill, can't handle his own affairs. That's the whole point of it. And in this trust, there was actually not only a reason going forward, but there was a history in the past, because one of the settlers was in fact incompetent, and so the parties that created this trust were well aware of the problems that are associated when a settler or a trustee is incompetent. And it in 10.09 set up a system that either the doctor, the physician, the person's personal physician could issue a certificate as to the competence of the trustee or settler, as the case may be, or in the alternative, there could be court proceedings. In this case, a certificate was obtained, and it was obtained by the appellant.
Now, Mr. Hamel, as I understood his argument, at least in part, is saying that, well, that was not a binding, that certificate didn't remove the power of appointment. It was evidence of testamentary capacity. I mean, as I understand his argument, he's saying there's one question, testamentary capacity. And this 10.09 simply says that this letter can be considered with regard to testamentary capacity. And because this court's already decided that he had testamentary capacity, the letter is in effect worthless.
No, I would disagree, and from the standpoint that in what I forget the citation of the case, but I call it Scott 2. When this Scott 2 was decided, the court really is concerned, I think, about two things. And one is, was the certificate, in a sense, issued for the purpose it purported to be issued? Was it obtained to certify whether William had lacked capacity? And because of some evidence that was put in as to that there was some evidence that suggested that the certificate was something of a red herring. It was to obtain some tax benefits, which the court actually noted in its opinion as being a dubious situation, and a situation that was, in fact, when it was reheard by the probate court, that position was retracted. It was not. In fact, the evidence was such that the certificate was obtained for the purpose of making a determination that this William, the settler, the trustee, was incompetent. But the court also, I think, had another point. It said it was wondering, and it's a fair question, was it still in effect a year later? Because you recall that the certificate, I think, was issued in something like April of 1996, and the purported exercise took place in December of 1997. The court had the question, well, is that certificate still out there? Does it still have efficacy? Is it a viable determination? And that's why the court dug in and took evidence. And I don't think there's any question, if anybody's reading through the 47 pages of the order, this is a court that was very, very careful in reviewing the facts. And the court made two determinations that were absolutely in response to Scott 2's instructions, and those were determine if the certificate was in fact obtained and related to the competency of William on the date that the certificate was obtained, and was that certificate or his competency still, or he lacked competency on the date that he actually attempted to exercise.
Pardon me for interrupting, and I don't want to put words in Mr. Hamel's mouth, so please understand this vocabulary is mine and not his. In reading what you've called Scott 2, the last section, section 2B, talks about this precise issue. It's Mr. Hamel's position, I think, that 2B shouldn't have been written, because the resolution of the codicil part really takes care of the whole case, and that these issues are so inextricably intertwined that 2B shouldn't have been issued. What is your response to that?
Well, I think that what is really a kind of a question, was there an impediment on one side, or did the codicil somehow have the power of eclipsing the impediment? And I think the thing is that the exercise, it says that the exercise is to take place in the through a testamentary device, but the thing is, at the point that William is exercising, he has nothing to exercise because the power was qualified. He had to be He had to have capacity at that time. Let me give you an example, and I think that maybe this gets a little closer. Let's assume that the, nothing to do with capacity is in the trust. It just says that the grantee has the power to exercise a power appointment in, except in the year of his death. Now, let's assume that he exercises the power appointment, this is my example, in June 1, and he dies on July 1. There is no power appointment. It was qualified that he couldn't exercise in the day of his death, year of his death. That's what's going on here. He didn't have a power appointment because he lacked the capacity under the trust. Everything he did under that trust, he couldn't do. If he would have tried to give, if he had tried at that point to be to make gifts as a trustee, because he was a trustee, initially he was one of the co-trustees, he had no power. He lacked power. And that is the reason that we don't even, you have to look at in the sense of you're going into the situation rather than looking back and saying, well, you know, I can sign this codicil and that overcomes my lack of power.
So are you saying that we have actually a different test, which was defined by section 10.09, applied at the time that the letter was written, and we do not apply the Cunningham test to that? Cunningham, of course, is very important and necessary for the analysis of the second codicil and testamentary capacity, but aren't we talking about a different mental issue, which I would call mental competence to exercise the power of appointment?
I would say we're talking about a different test, but I think it has to do with what is the governing instrument under which the power of appointment was created. And the governing instrument, and that's defined in the probate code, the governing instrument here is the trust that provided for the power of appointment.
So basically the issue is what the probate court found was that Mark had proven by preponderance of the evidence that WC lacked the capacity to exercise the power of appointment. Is that correct?
I would only add, Your Honor, that under the terms of the trust, he lacked the power to exercise the power of appointment.
Mr. Sims. Oh, Sims.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Mr. Sims, 10.09 says for purposes, in pertinent part, for purposes of this trust, an individual may be treated as being under legal disability, incompetent, or incapacitated, if so certified in writing by his or her physician. May be treated by whom? I mean, it's kind of a passive voice there. For purposes of this trust, an individual may be treated as being under legal disability.
It is passive. I think that in a sense, that's what the court looked at. Certainly, the trial court's looking at that, whether or not even though it may be, you may look at it, he may be treated as, that's the whole point. When it went back to the trial court looked at it from beginning to end. It looked at events that led up to the obtaining the certificate. And you might note, I know, and the court specifically pointed out that immediately following the appellant obtaining the certificate, he called a family meeting. They got everyone together. The whole point, he needed it, and to his credit, he was trying to protect his father from going in an institution and that. He brought everybody in. The point is, the may, I suspect, here can be looked at in terms of what happened at or about the time the certificate was obtained, what followed immediately, and then the court in Scott 2, I believe, said, let's look ahead. Let's see if there was some reason that all of a sudden that certificate should not be considered as determinative anymore. And to make that determination, then the court got in to the test as to competency.
Well, Dean, I understand what we're trying to do here, partially, WC's test metric capacity at the time he made the will and the time of the power of appointment, is that correct? That essentially the...
Yes, I, yeah.
You agree that he had, test metric capacity at the time he made the will?
Yes, my point here is that's irrelevant to the determination, because it's the trust, the governing instrument that controls whether he had. It's much like Judge Carparelli was talking about the Brooklyn Bridge. He didn't have anything. He had nothing to exercise. If he would, would we be talking about this if there was no power of appointment, but he purports codicil to exercise a power of appointment? That's really, I think, what I'm talking about is tantamount to that situation. There was no power of appointment, because perhaps it's just by the luck of the draw, it's what was in the instrument when they drew it up, that they provided that there was a limitation.
Well, would you agree or disagree with the following statement, that Samuel, that is, further contends that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law to prove WC lacked test metric capacity under Cunningham because Mark offered no evidence that WC lacked test metric capacity at the time he executed the second clause?
And that's from the standpoint of that summary judgment motion?
My statement is something I've written, and I want to know if it's correct. Would you agree or disagree with it?
No, we disagreed. We went back to court to prove that he didn't have... I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't believe, given the order in Scott 2, that I can say whether I maybe didn't like the order, but I can't say as I can't agree to it, because the court ordered that William had testamentary capacity to execute the codicil. My point is, in part 2, Scott said, but the real issue here is not whether he had capacity to exercise the codicil, it's whether he had did he have a power of appointment. If he didn't have capacity under the trust, he didn't have a power of appointment.
Well, the opinion in 119 is whether WC lacked test metric capacity under Cunningham because Mark offered no evidence that WC lacked test metric capacity at the time he executed the second. Is that an interpretation?
No, I think that's, as I understand it at this moment, I don't know that that's an unfair statement. But I think that you have to look at it from the standpoint of, I guess, whether you're looking back or you're looking forward. And when William sat down on December 24th, Christmas Eve, did he have a power of appointment to exercise? And I believe we maintained, and the court found without question, that he did not have a power of appointment.
Why did he not have?
Because he didn't have capacity. That's it.
That's the heart of it.
That's the heart of it.
And that testimony, why do you think that Judge Stewart, the trial judge, was so looking at 119 Pacific Third, why she took it upon herself to have an evidentiary hearing of which many witnesses testified, Dr. O'Wagga, W.C.'s granddaughter, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I didn't ever get to talk to her personally on this, but certainly in court, I think my position is that when you look at Scott 2, she had to. That's what I think Scott 2 was saying. If there was no case, why would even remand with instructions?
Well,
I mean, I don't like that hypothetical, but the point is, the court, yes, Scott too said the codicil's in, but that doesn't mean every provision in the codicil will necessarily result in a distribution. But for instance, a person writes a will, all the capacity he needs, and he leaves out his wife. Well, we know that the wife has an elective share. Well, that won't work. The predetermined child. There are provisions just simply in fact, I looked at this quite a bit, tried to figure out what is probate. Probate is basically allowing the instrument to come in and then to execute on it to the extent that the particular provisions are valid. And it's not just anything that comes in, that's the way it goes. Because they may not turn out that way. The instrument comes in. I mean, I remember talking about this to Judge Stewart. In fact, the codicil, until it's admitted, it's just simply hearsay. Now, when the gavel goes down and it's admitted to probate, it's now going to be looked at to see to what extent it's going to be executed on, or the distributions are going to be made, and so. Maybe that's ahead of myself. I'm at the point back here, back on December 24th, was he subject to this qualification that was in the trust? And our position is he was. And that's exactly what the probate court went back and examined, looked at the whole history of when that certificate came about and what happened with respect to the certificate right up to the 24th of December 1997. And there was no evidence. Really, no evidence that this man, and I don't say this in a derogatory fashion, but he was not here with us. He lived in the moment. That was the testimony, and Judge Stewart looked at that and reported that. He lived in the moment. He didn't have a past, and he didn't have a future. In fact, the testimony even at the time was the attorney testified that he discussed this matter with him, but he didn't know that William was essentially blind. He couldn't read. He couldn't read anything. As I recall, it's been a while, his glasses are like binoculars. He didn't have anything. And as a result, Judge Stewart said, "I'm not considering any of the testimony from the lawyer because it looks like it's all, it has no basis." If any other questions, I'm going to stick to my outline. I'm going to move on to the surcharge issue, and I think this is actually an area that the court was questioning Mr. Hamill about essentially in the beginning, and that is one thing I think a common law would point out: a trust is defined as a relationship, and a lot of the laws is evolved so that now if you make filings, a trust seems to have an identity to itself. But a trust is really a relationship between the settlor and the trustee for the benefit of beneficiaries and maybe the settlor. And to start parsing that the trust wasn't somehow named as either the petitioner or the plaintiff, I think misses the point. This case was brought initially, was initiated. It was a proceeding initiated by Mark. Mark was an interested party. The court points that out. He was actually a contingent beneficiary and had no present interest until his grandfather died. And what you have is, the definition of a proceeding in the probate code is, a petition. First, the petition is defined as a request for an order. That's the probate court definition. And what is a proceeding? A proceeding includes both actions at law and suits at equity or inequity. So what Mark did, he initiated. And it's, there is no question under 1516201 that the probate court has jurisdiction concerning the affairs of a trust and securing administration according to its terms. Essentially, the probate court sits over a trust and has the power to inquire into the activities of the trust, and in particular, the activities of the trustee on behalf of the various beneficiaries and persons having interest in the trust. I think it misses the point supremely to think that the trust is going to file or somehow come into the case. In typically, when a trust is sued, you sue the trustee, who may not have any personal liability under the statute.
Mr. Hamill states in this statement, the final order of the probate court answered my question was in December of 2007, and it was the final order in judgment procedure. What's your position on that?
That the final order was for the trust?
I can't remember the exact words, but he said that the final order and judgment of the court was in December of 2007. So therefore, your motion to dismiss on that issue should be denied. If there is a final order, in effect.
This is a tough issue for me because, as we know, the cases, this whole issue of when there is a final order or an appealable order, has gone all the way to the Supreme Court. I was there. And while I didn't like the decision in this court on that matter, we filed the petition, quite frankly.
Was there a final order in judgment in December of 2007?
I'm prepared to concede there was.
All right.
I am.
So, what does that mean? That your motion, that the motion to dismiss the trust case is inappropriate or not, should be denied?
Yeah, that the court. My point is, the court has jurisdiction over this appeal. That's what I'm.
Because there is a final order.
Yes.
And that was Mr. Hamill's argument. Is that correct?
Yes, I.
That has to do with trust. Now, back to the will. Go ahead.
I know that the court entered a final order, has set out not only, has gone so far as to lay out the remedies that are to be executed on, and has also laid out the damages to the extent there were damages. So I think in all respects, for purposes of perhaps getting this case resolved after 10 years, I'm prepared to concede that the court has jurisdiction. I know that's not binding on the court by any means. But
I understand. Now, the second question I have is this. Mr. Hamill again argues that it was inappropriate or that the trial court erred in awarding attorney fees and particularly punitive damages.
Let me.
And I think that if I'm not mistaken, there would be an award of punitive damage and attorney fees to Samuel, not as to the guest of trust itself. Is that correct?
That's right. That is right. And I think the court was quite careful about the parameters of when and under what circumstances it has the authority to enter an order of punitive damages or exemplary damages. This takes a little broader view, but this case, it actually runs over not 10 years. This case starts, or related cases start back in about 1992. When Samuel first came into this case, he was a conservator for his mother. And they created this trust, and at her death, he had certain duties, and one was he was, if sufficient assets were there, he was to create a GST, generation skipping trust, and he was to transfer certain property to the family trust. He didn't do that. He didn't do it. That duty, he was responsible, he had control of that property when he was a conservator. He didn't do it. And at the end of the day, that he had been removed as a trustee. He is no longer in a situation of being coerced in as a trustee to do something. He had, on behalf of his mother, an obligation to transfer property. He didn't do it. And under that Supreme Court case, Peterson, the Supreme Court said, in situations like this, where we're not talking about coercing a trustee to do something, he is, in a sense, no longer a trustee. The probate court has authority to impose punitive damages. There are extensive findings, and I won't bore the court with it, but there are extensive findings about the manipulations that the appellant exercised, so to speak, in keeping property in his own name, moving it and not allowing it to come into the trust. And the court, and even up to the point, and I think this is particularly important, for 8 years or 7 years, we had requested information about some particular matters.
Assuming all that to be absolutely
right.
Correct.
Okay.
Assuming all that, does the court have authority, the trial court have authority to impose punitive damages against Samuel for the conduct of which you've been?
Yes, two reasons. And I'll mention one of them. A proceeding includes both actions at law and suits in equity. So the court does, even though traditionally we look at a probate court as a court sitting in equity, it's clear that the probate code allows the court to consider both sitting both in law and in equity. And in the situation of punitive damages, they can only be awarded in actions at law. They could not be awarded in matters of equity. Second is Peterson. The Peterson decision affirmed an award of punitive damages against a former trustee in a probate matter, in a trust matter.
Well, of course, you understand or recognize, Mr., that on the Supreme Court, is not right. Not infallible because it's right, infallible because it's last.
Here's the law, and I can't even remember, Your Honor, if you were on the court on the Peterson, but you may well have signed that opinion.
Mr. Shipps, my concern then is, let's assume that we conclude we have a final appealable order, that we rule with regard to that order, the December 07 order, and a mandate issues. What happens to these issues out there regarding Holt's supposedly excessive fees, his unreasonable fees, Samuel's attempt to remove Holt as the trustee? Are those still in the case, or are those all gone? Well, is there a new case number, or what happened?
Well, it's not a different case number, but you know, the court in the appeal of Scott 2 up didn't seem to parse between whether we had different case numbers. I must admit to the court, I was puzzled. We honestly did not think that this court had jurisdiction in Scott 2. And I'm not sure, I don't want to say anything bad about the decision on up, but I have a harder time figuring out what the court, what the Supreme Court has done here. It's very difficult. I'm puzzled. I can only think that at least, I would say the answer in this way, and then I'll get off. At least with respect to the appellant and this appellee, I think you have a final decision.
Thank you. Mr. Hamill, can you address that? What happens to these remaining claims that against Mr. Holt and What claims are still out there?
The claims that are still out there are those that are framed by the petition that was filed by Samuel Scott against Mr. Holt as trustee. Mr. Holt is not a party to the cases before this court today, and you've already heard my view on that. We started a new petition. Judge Rivera was absolutely correct. Objections were filed in the trust case as to his compensation. They were filed because there was never an order permitting him to obtain compensation. He never sought compensation. He simply took it out of the trust. That compensation cost, as of today, is over $700,000. And there's never been an application to the probate court for any of that.
So that's still all sitting there, but your objection to those fees is still sitting there.
Absolutely. On a separate petition.
On a separate petition, but wasn't there a decision of this court in November of 2006 that said, no, this is all one case?
No, what that court decision said, I'm thinking the same one, we've been here several times, as you know.
We'll call it three.
I'm going to have to take out a membership here pretty quick. But what that court said was that what we were objecting to then, which was his method of accounting, was something that was subsumed by the petition, the new petition that was existing. And it would not have been, it was not, the determination we were seeking there would not have been binding ultimately because of that new petition. And so
are you saying, Mr. Hamill, simplify it for a minute.
Sure.
And basically what we have to do is send that part of the case back to the trial court for the purposes of debating the determination by having a hearing or whatever it might be appropriate. But here, the whole matter relating to the fees of this whole, whether they're proper or not proper.
Yeah, I don't think you need to remand it to the court. I just don't think it's before the court here, because if you look at the Supreme Court decision in Scott, it says, take a look at the petition. The petition frames the issues to be determined, and that is a proceeding. Here we have three petitions, one by Samuel Scott and two by Mark Scott. Those frame the issues here. Now we have another petition. It is not unusual in probate, as I'm sure this court is aware, to have various petitions. That was the issue that was addressed by the Supreme Court in the Scott decision, saying, okay, we can't just let everything sit for 100 years until the last petition has been determined. Where we have a discrete set of issues framed by pleadings, a petition and a response, then that sets a proceeding. And when that proceeding has been determined, then it's appealable. The fact that you might have other proceedings still pending in front of the probate court is really irrelevant, and that's what we have here. So this court would have to do nothing with respect to that pending petition, deal with these three petitions, and that's probably a full enough plate for almost anybody here. So
thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you both. I'm pleased that we granted you the additional time. It was helpful. And thank you also for submitting your outlines and for following them. That was also helpful. We assure you it won't be another 10 years here. The case now stands submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. And with that, if Bailiff, if you'll announce that Division 6 is adjourned.
All right. Being recessed.